Welcome, folks, to the Slowpokes podcast. As always, I am Slowpoke number two, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number one, John Nicolaitis.
We're here today to talk about What Remains of Edith Finch, the game that we've covered for this episode on the PlayStation. Nope, I played it on PC. I don't know why I said that.
It's okay. So this is a game by Giant Sparrow, of which we've played one of their previous games, Unfinished Swan.
Yes, so yeah. You might have heard that episode. I struggled to remember where we landed on Unfinished Swan.
I think I quite enjoyed Unfinished Swan. And you were like 7.
Yeah, that I feel like I would have been like 7.5 out of 10. Just a very good, but not much more than good.
I remember after playing it, I was like, oh, this game. Oh, wow. And I was left with a sense of wonder and enjoyment.
Yeah, I wasn't.
Yeah. So, you know, let's see if the trend with Giant Sparrow continues in my utter enraptment of what they create.
Maybe this is kind of revealing my hand a little bit here, but I think perhaps you should talk about your experience on the general level with the game before I go into mine.
Well, a lot of people I know actually told me to play What Remains of Edith Finch.
Yeah.
A lot of people talked about it in general in being like, oh, this is kind of going to be a really interesting walking simulator kind of game. And, you know, it does all this stuff and blah. I didn't hear a lot about it from the culture, mostly because I ignore it. But people close to me, they were going, have you played it yet? You should play it. Are you doing it for the show? You should do it for the show.
Yeah, see, I don't have enough friends for that to be my primary recommendation source.
Whereas I have 3 more friends than David.
And that's 3 more opportunities. So I mainly heard about this from the culture, from, you know, games critics and from end of year lists for 2017. I mean, 2017 is being lauded as an incredible year for video games for a lot of good reasons. We had some really amazingly good releases that year, and this is often pointed to as one of them. One of the big things that I heard a lot was that it basically is the epitome of what a walking sim can be. It takes that genre and does the absolute best it possibly can with it. And so you can understand that my expectations were colored by that to some extent.
Set to the ceiling, really.
Yeah.
What's that number past 11? I think it's 1,000. I swear, all the people you listen to, they always give such high praise of things.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things I want to mention about that. First and foremost, it's that I'm not immediately suckered in by that. It's not like I go, well, I guess this is going to be literally the best game I've ever played then.
David, are you telling me you're slightly cynical about things?
I'm saying that I approach things with a reasonable level of skepticism.
Yes, that sounds like how a cynic would phrase this.
But when it comes to Edith Finch, I think it's also really important that a lot of the games I've played recently where I've been told that they do the absolute best in their genre that you can do, and they're almost sort of, not the epitaph of their genre, but the logical conclusion of their genre in recent times has been true. I mean, we did Horizon Zero Dawn for our first episode of this season, and that was the thing that a lot of people said about that, and it turned out to be fucking true. That game really is about as far as you can take the Ubisoft collect-a-thon open world formula in terms of quality and polish and thematic weight. It's an amazingly good game.
Yeah, I think what's really important about this comparison here is Horizon Zero Dawn uses all of the Ubisoft components. Like, it uses all of the collectathon stuff.
Yeah.
But it transformed them into something I found enjoyable and worthwhile and not a complete waste of your time as you search for feathers.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I say I was expecting something like that for this, I mean, obviously I'm using that as an analogy here. Like, I wasn't expecting this to be the best game I've ever played. I did not expect to go into this and say, yep, that was better than Firewatch, but I did expect something that really pushed the boundaries of what a walking sim can be. And I did not get that. I feel like I got the sequel to Unfinished Swan. You know, like, it is eerie how much my experience of Unfinished Swan mirrors my experience here, because I also went into Unfinished Swan expecting it to be more than it ended up being. And in both cases, I don't feel like those expectations harmed my experience, but they were definitely proven to be inaccurate. The expectations I had were proven to be inaccurate in about the same way both times.
Yeah, now that you say that, it kind of makes me think, and I would also agree that this is, to me, the sequel to Unfinished Swan. But in the way that differs to how you feel about it, to me, it's because the game is resonant of, like, the emotional feelings that I felt it conveyed successfully in terms of what death can mean in a family and what a house can be and all these kind of things. I remember sitting after this game had finished and it made me question and think about my own life and what I want out of things and where I want to go and how many walls I want to tear down in my own house one day.
And like, I have had that experience playing games, but I didn't have it for either of the Giant Sparrow games.
And there's something really interesting, because I feel like there's some experiences you have, some games you play, some media you consume that is so resonant for you.
Yeah.
And that completely washes over what feels like 80% of people. Not everybody, but like a majority.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting that there are... there's art that I consume that doesn't speak directly to my own personal experience. Get Out is an example of that. Thor Ragnarok, to some extent. Yep. Like, I mean, it speaks to my culpability of colonialism, but not necessarily my experience of colonialism, that kind of thing. And I find those to be very, very moving pieces on those thematic levels, right? Like, Get Out does not speak to my experience, but then again, I suppose I am involved in those interactions from the antagonist end of it. And so maybe that's part of why I feel more involved, potentially. Yeah. But with something like this, which, you know, I actually do have on paper more direct relation to than the experience of the protagonist in something like Get Out, it still just doesn't really move me. And I think that it's going to be a fun conversation today to talk about some of the differences between you and I and our experiences to this game.
Oh, we're going to get personal.
What I will say, because it does sound like I'm underselling it, it is a good game.
Yeah.
And I definitely understand the quality to it. And I also understand how subjective a game like this can be. So I wouldn't go out of my way to recommend this to like everyone, but there are definitely specific people I can think of who would love a game like this, and I would never go as far as to say manage your expectations to somebody who was excited about playing it. Does that make sense?
You know, totally. I always feel like when I listen to people in the culture and I find reviewers that I trust and agree with, you have to understand a little bit about how they feel about different types of media.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that what you gave is, it might not feel like a clear response. It is actually pretty clear in what you're saying. And like when I say to people who know who I am and know what games I like, especially if they listen to the show, and I would say wholeheartedly, I recommend this game to people. I want everyone to play this game to experience it just to see how they react and what they think about it. But again, I know there are people out there who experience games in a more arcadey kind of way, perhaps.
Yeah.
And
that's definitely me. I'm all about just crushing those high scores.
David, you're the Gallagher King. That's what they call you. I've never seen you not teabagging something. He's teabagging someone right. Who is that? Who are you?
It's just my most recent scrub that I pwned in my online shooter of choice this week.
God, we'll never be divorced of frat boys, will we?
But yeah, no, I totally understand what you mean. Everybody seeks different things. And the truth is, while I would never say my analytical approach to art is a bad thing, I do have a more analytical approach to art than most people, and that affects the level of critical-mindedness I approach something
with. Critique would be the word I would use.
Yeah, and so part of the reason I think my experience with this is less enthused than other people is because part of the way I approach it is not just as a art student and as a literature critic, but also as a writer, less so, but as someone who has practiced writing and knows what I want from writing.
And I think that's really interesting you brought it up, because I've had a lot of frustration recently in absorbing the sort of critique of certain people who have that analytic lens. People who go and make things and make films and make movies and media, I've sometimes listened to them talk about a work that I appreciate and being like, oh, but you're not understanding the emotional resonance. And it's because they're looking at it from a really structured lens, and they may not be wrong.
Yeah, and I will also say that while in some cases that does make me less susceptible to emotional manipulation, it doesn't mean that I'm unwilling to experience that emotional effect. I mean, one of our more recent episodes was Journey. That's going to come up a couple of times in this episode as a point of comparison.
Mm-hmm.
Even when I replayed that just for the episode, I was surprised that it still was so moving to me and so affecting, even though I'd already gone through it once and knew what that path was like. And I've since gone and really honed my analytical mind when it comes to approaching art, that Journey still really moved me, and this game just kind of didn't. There is something that we will hopefully discover through this discussion that didn't click.
If you haven't noticed already, this is going to be very rambly. If you're looking for a very tight, structured episode that sort of explores the philosophical text, I'd probably point you at Soma or something.
Yeah, or the Beginner's Guide, something like that.
One of those earlier episodes we did where we had a bit of a firmer idea of what we were going to talk about. here we're really just going to go straight through Rambletown and talk about how we feel.
Yeah, absolutely. We've deliberately kind of left this episode a bit less structured, so I'm probably just going to say at this point, if you want to go spoiler-free, this probably isn't a great episode for you, because we're going to be all over the place, and there's not going to be a clear line between spoiler and non-spoiler stuff.
Yeah, and I'm going to start talking about which butler killed who and everything like that.
Absolutely.
After.
The other thing I will mention as well is this game does cover the topic of death, and so if you do have particular sensitivities towards the death of close family members, or particularly the death of infants and children, you might also want to give this one a miss.
Yeah, even though the game does style things in a certain way, I think that still doesn't detract from that fact.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
So, it's really interesting that you bring up death, because for me, what remains of Edith Finch is all it's talking about on that really surface level. Mm. It's like a story about people, a family, and how they die.
Yeah.
And how that affects all of them.
Yeah, so there's a couple of themes here, and normally we'd leave the themes to the end, but just to help maybe kind of clarify this mess of a conversation we're about to have, probably the three biggest themes are, as you said, death is one of them. So, you know, the mystery and the narratives we weave around death, the effect that death of people close to us has on ourselves. And
the stories that we tell of those deaths.
Yeah. The other one is family, obviously, very closely related, but you play as Edith Finch re-exploring her family childhood home. And so she revisits other members of her family and some of their stories and what that meant for her and her growing up and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you kind of play as her. I think the way the game presents itself is part of the experience, but in a sense, yes.
But like, that's the core narrative delivery mechanism, is that Edith is revisiting the home and exploring the stories of her other family members.
Sort of. I mean, the game... yes. Let's go with yes. We'll talk about it later.
Okay. Obviously, we're going to get into it more deeply, but as far as the premise on the box...
Definitely on the box. I think the on-the-box advertising for this game is like, check out the weird stories of this strange family, and I want to strangle that PR person.
The final theme of the big three is the power of stories themselves and the effect that they have on the way we live our lives and that kind of thing.
The power they have over us and our paths.
The most literal way that comes out in the story is that Edith's mother is trying to prevent Edith for some of her life from learning about the stories of the family and the myths that surround the family because she's kind of feeling like a sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So with the Finches, there's a history of them all seeming to die at odd and extreme ends.
Yeah.
And in fact, the forebearer who moved to America from, I can't remember what Nordic country it was now, but he moved the house. They literally put the house on a boat and shipped it to America to escape this curse of the family where everyone would die. And it did not work, apparently. And these stories, it's like the whole house is laid out like a memorial to all of these people. And you go and you read all of their stories and the main character's mother ends up responding to this call by sealing all of the rooms where all of these stories are maintained.
Yeah, so at some point she goes and seals all of the bedrooms of the family members who have died before her and her children.
And I think she's counterpointed by Edie, which is Edith Finch's grandmother, who's the person who...
Great-grandmother.
No.
Okay, so you've got Edith Finch and her mum, Dawn.
Yes.
And her dad is Sam.
Oh.
And Edie is Sam's mother. Edith Finch, her great-grandmother is Edie.
I can't count.
Okay, so this is another thing I'll quickly get out of the way. The game pause menu is a family tree, and thank fuck. Like, thank fuck, because it's at least four generations of people, depending on how you kind of envision it. And if I did not have this family tree in the pause menu every time I hit escape, it's bang right there, I would have lost track of who the fuck we were talking about so much.
Mm. Yeah, I wasn't very clear on it either, but it didn't bother me at all. Sometimes, this is actually really interesting, sometimes there are structure in a narrative that would be useful to know, but you can gloss over it if you're being involved in the experience.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes the strict exposition and plot points aren't super relevant. For me, I felt it was relevant enough because certain stories were informed by the other stories that happened around them. So especially with Edith's mum, Dawn, the way she sealed up the house, it was relevant to know what happened immediately before that and actually pushed her to do that. I felt that was important.
I felt the understanding the whole family structure was hard, and thank God there was a picture for it.
Yeah.
But I felt that I still knew who interplayed with who in terms of the specific stories.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes that was clearer than other times, but I had trouble keeping track of it, and I was glad that it was there. There were definitely stories that I double checked afterwards and something clicked about the flow of the story when I double checked the family tree after the story. So for those of you who don't know, I imagine most of you do have a vague idea of how the actual structure of the game works, but the way the play unfolds is that you as Edith Finch go back to this house, you're exploring through the rooms and whatnot, and as you find your way through, you know, sort of secret passages and tunnels, because it's a weird, kooky old mansion that's got all of these secret passages and fun stuff like that in it. When you head into a room of a family member, you'll find their diary or some other motif that they left behind.
A poem by someone else.
Yeah, and it sort of takes you into a scene of that character and generally that character's final moments in life. And the game is kind of painted as this magical realism game with unreliable narration. And so a lot of these stories are somewhat fantastical. Some of them are very colorful. Some of them are quite tonally, not dour, but a little bit, you know, grayer than some of the ones that are a bit more fun. But it's never really terrifying or never truly upsetting, I would say, from a tonal perspective.
Yeah, for a game that it basically shows you vignettes of people's last moments.
A lot of whom are children.
Yeah, who are quite young. I feel that it handles that in a very interesting way.
Yeah, and for me, there were a couple of moments where the tone I felt was not quite as respectful as it should have been. Maybe respectful is the wrong word, but it wasn't the kind of tone that I would put in there, and that kind of made me take a step back from the experience. And I think for other people who were more capable of just kind of letting go and going along with the ride, then that tone would have been less alien to them.
I think there's a specific moment in this game, in one of the stories, that really speaks to this, and I feel like we should just talk about it now to get into depth.
Do you remember the name of the character? Because I don't.
Gregory.
Gregory, yeah.
Yes, so one of the children of in the game, not even going to try describing the story structure.
Basically, someone like halfway down the tree-ish.
Basically, Edith Finch's her uncle.
Yeah.
Basically died as a child. And
A young child under the age of 2, definitely, probably less than 1 year old.
And the way the game brings you through this experience is by sort of fantasticalizing the death.
Yeah, absolutely.
To put it bluntly, it's really hard to describe the death of a child.
It is. I'm gonna just state what the blandness of the situation is, and then we'll talk about how they color it. Yeah. So this child, it is implied, drowns in the bathtub. The way that unfolds, though, is that the kid is playing in the bath, and it has this almost like Fantasia-esque musical dance happening in front of him with all of the bath toys.
It's like a soaring orchestral piece that plays throughout the whole experience that builds up and builds down as everything unfolds.
Mm.
And you control this little toy frog as it collects little miniatures, and they perform this dance in the bath with
And you've got these cute rubber duckies, and they're all, you know, it's dancing around in a circle, and this big inflatable toy whale that's bouncing around and looks just like the most friendly, lovable thing in the world.
And I'm pretty sure the kid's giggling as well. I can feel the joy that's taking place in this moment. And then, you know, you're there alone in this bathtub, and your mother comes in and goes, oh, I better pull the plug. And then as she goes to pull the plug, the phone rings and she walks out of the room. And then that's when you turn the tap back on.
Mm.
And unfortunately, this is when Gregory dies.
Yeah.
But the game doesn't show you that. What happens is this orchestral ballad of all of the little toys dancing and singing and playing around becomes more and more grandiose as it builds towards this thing. And during this whole experience, you're hearing the narration of the child's father writing a letter to his wife on their divorce papers, talking about the experience and sort of coloring it with how he's trying to think about it, how he's trying to think about the joy and the fact that his child was always laughing and found everything to be so much fun, while this child is having this joyful experience as they drown.
Yeah, and like once the water goes above the child's head, it sort of takes that to a much more fantastical extreme, where you actually become sort of like this little sea monster.
You become the frog, basically.
Oh, the frog, yeah. You become the frog swimming in a lake, and the whale is now the size of an actual whale, and it culminates with you kind of metaphorically swimming down the drain of the bathtub. And
white light, pretty clear what it's trying to say.
And so there's metaphor in that, but one of the things I find that stops me connecting with Edith Finch, and it's such a hollow thing to say, is I feel like a lot of the ideas and a lot of the individual stories work on paper, but when they're executed and when they're assembled into this anthology, don't really connect in a meaningful way, not only to me, but to one another.
I find that so interesting because I would want to say the exact opposite statement.
See, I feel like sometimes when you watch a movie or when you experience a piece of art, there are clear themes. Now, themes don't necessarily have to be intended by the author,
yeah.
But I do sometimes find that people write themes backwards, if that makes sense. Like, they'll take a look at something and it's like, okay, yeah, so this vaguely kind of implies some things about death, so I suppose that'll be the theme of this anthology. And I keep using that term anthology because I feel like these stories are a lot more separate than, like, the unifying structure of this of these different stories is informed by being connected to Edith Finch and being family members of her and her exploring them in this house. It's a framing technique. It's not really, to me, a series of, like, fully unified chapters of a complete text. Yeah. I feel like they're...
You're saying that if they took away that frame, you couldn't... They're just a series of unconnected experiences.
Yeah, I feel like there is work being performed to tie these stories together, and that work that's being done doesn't actually complete that. Like,
yeah,
obviously they're all stories about death. Obviously they're all stories about the power of stories.
Yeah, but when the stories themselves don't do the work of connecting each other, that can make it apparent that they're really just the frame is how
it's. And I think a really big problem with this is the way it's seeded in the first one. So you've got Molly's story as the first one that you see from Edith. Now, Molly's story is basically she was sent to bed early because she was naughty, so she didn't have any dinner. So she wakes up and she's hungry. And she tries to, you know, look around her room for anything she can eat. She eats the food for her pet gerbil, which is like a carrot or a turnip or something. Yep. And then she goes into the bathroom and eats the toothpaste. And then she sees a cat out the window, or a bird out the window, and then she becomes a cat who's chasing down the bird to eat the bird.
Yeah.
After that, she becomes an owl who's chasing down rabbits to eat them, and then she becomes some kind of weird sea monster on a boat hunting down people to eat them, and then the story culminates with that sea monster crawling along a drain, coming up and hiding under Molly's bed, and then Molly kind of eating herself, and that's how Molly dies in this story. And so you have this really weird story that isn't super related to these themes of the power of stories, or, you know, Molly is the first character who dies in America other than Odin is the original, like, grandfather,
yes.
Right? Yeah, Odin is the one who tries to bring the house over. He dies at sea, so Molly is the first Finch to die in America. And so her story isn't really informed by, like, inheriting the fear of that from previous generations or anything. It's just this really cool short story that doesn't really work thematically with any of the other stories in Peace. Does that make sense? Like, I feel like that's indicative of part of why this didn't really land with me. And this is where we're kind of going back to the whole, to a lot of people, they wouldn't be thinking about it necessarily this deeply. But I think that was probably the weakest story in the whole lot. And it's so bizarre to me that they made it the first one, because not only is it the most boring, it is also the least relevant to what the themes of the game supposedly are.
It is one of the more fantastical stories.
It's also
though.
One of the longest as well.
I would agree that it sets up a weird precedent because it's kind of this weird transformation that the character goes through and the length of it. It was really noticeable to me when I played this one, and then everyone after that was like half the size or less.
Yeah, and this is where I'm sort of getting to that whole thing about, like, the themes don't do the work for themselves, the story doesn't do the work for themselves. I feel like I have to do it. Like, is the sea monster a thing about the house sinking at sea? Like, is that maybe where that link is supposed to be? But, like, that feels like such a stretch.
Yeah,
you know?
To me, this is a fever dream of a child who died of an illness. And
okay.
Right? And that sort of ties into the idea.
Yeah, that works better.
Yeah, but admittedly, it doesn't give you that context.
Yeah, again, like, it's a much better explanation that maybe this child had some kind of fevered illness and one of the symptoms of it was a ravenous appetite.
Yeah, because the moment I sort of got that Molly was sick was when she was eating the plastic berries from the Christmas decorations in her room. And I'm like, no regular person eats toothpaste and those berries and things like that. And then the fact that she kind of wakes up in her own bed and then writes her dream down, which is what I felt the short was. It just sort of reinforced this idea of going through the sickness and going mad with hunger and and then losing herself and then just dying. And it's a story of a child.
Yeah, and that's a much more satisfying explanation for it. But you told me that, yeah. Not the game.
And then I think when a game is trying to let you... So I feel like when a game is trying to affect you and it's trying to let you go on your own path through the experience, sometimes it doesn't do any work. It just shows you a thing.
Yeah.
It's like showing you a card in a doctor's office and going, how does this make you feel? Huh? How does this make you feel?
I'm reminded of things like the M. Night Shyamalan twist or the J.J. Abrams mystery box, where, again, these are ideas that work on paper, but the supporting structure around that one or two cool ideas just doesn't really come together. And I feel like with Edith Finch, all of these little stories have a cool idea, and the framing of it all being connected to the house, that's a cool idea, but it just doesn't click with me. It just doesn't have that interconnected tissue that really makes that come together.
And this can totally relate to the idea of why it doesn't sit with people well, because you're throwing your feelings at a dartboard, and sometimes you'll land a bullseye and it connects to you. These stories connect, and then sometimes they'll flow. Because for me, it feels like all these stories flow and connect because the story I'm telling of the stories does. Whereas your story of the stories does not connect. And then there's the structure itself, which I will admit sometimes does feel like it's a bit loose.
Yeah. That was a good point to make. I just don't know where to go from there.
Mic drop! I do want to just quickly go back to that scene with Gregory, though.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah.
Because we talked about it and then we kind of moved on. I just wanted to say that was one of the most affecting stories for me because I felt the juxtaposition of the father narrating the letter to his wife about how he doesn't blame her for what happened while you're playing Gregory and having this joyful, playful experience as he dies, essentially.
Yeah, and
it's not something you normally see when depicting a death of a child.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like I said, on paper, that idea kind of works, that you have the juxtaposition of the sorrow of the father who feels a level of regret but no blame, which is refreshing. He doesn't blame the mother who was technically the one watching over Gregory at the time. That, at the very least, I thought was refreshing. But I also feel like the tone that they took here really felt disconnected from the reality of losing an infant child. I do not have any children. I do not know what that feels like.
Neither do I.
But in that moment, I felt like there was this insistence from one character that this infant's life was magical and beautiful and full of joy, and the death is sad, but his life was wonderful and magical and full of joy. My experience with death is rarely that romantic. I mean, I have lost close family members. Excuse me there. I have lost close family members and friends in the past, and my relationship with those endings has never been, wow, I'm just so glad I had the chance to know them while they're alive. I mean, that fact is true, but that doesn't soften the reality and the sadness of death for me. Like, the logic just doesn't click, because I know this sounds so mechanical. Whenever somebody says, you know, a funeral is a celebration of life, I'm like, no, it's not. It is the marking of the end of a life. See, because we celebrate a life while a person's alive, you know?
I
still want more of this person's life. Yeah. That's not what the funeral is for. The funeral is for dealing with the loss.
I just think that having this sort of like double-layered kind of rose-tinted lens, because the death of a child is so extreme, it cuts through that regardless. The whole time I experienced this moment, I was always aware that a child is dead. It's a big deal. That's really sad, right? And then to have the joyful, like the child being joyful, the father telling this story, I felt like as I experienced it, I could sit on this fence and I could lean into his fantasy about how he had these joyful moments and how he was always full of such laughs and jokes, and I wonder what beauty he saw in the world. And then I can always pull back and just imagine what could be there. And like, you know, small caskets and whatnot and just true sadness. But how much of that work is me doing that in my own mind? And how much is there in the game?
Yeah, and especially with a topic that sensitive. I mean, it is a difficult plate to keep spinning. It is a difficult line to walk and find that balance between the appropriate level of tragedy and also like this weirdly cathartic kind of romanticism.
Yeah.
We should talk a little bit about magic realism to some extent, because to me, magic realism is a really loosely defined kind of idea. There are some places that it works, but I find that most of the time where I see magic realism, they just don't really capture me with a sense of wonder or a sense of, like,
oddness, out of place.
Yeah, they don't pull me in with it. I think the only time it's really worked was, and I almost hesitate to say this because I haven't seen this movie in like 15 years. But have you seen Big Fish with Ewan McGregor?
Yes.
Yeah, that one kind of pulled me in. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time in games, like in something like this, a lot of the time the magic realism I feel is just something that prevents me from fully accessing what's really there and what's really behind it.
Mm.
I don't need everything to be perfectly literal all the time, but I do feel that that's a fog that prevents me from accessing what I'm supposed to access, you know?
I sort of know, because when I encounter magical realism, a lot of the time I find it more illuminating than people blankly saying lines on a screen, especially when a Big Fish is a perfect example, when you like sort of come back and rewatch that movie and think about it even more. The way those stories are fantastical bleeds into the point that the stories are telling. You know, stories are really interesting things because they're a way we connect with each other and they're a way we express ideas, and they change depending on where we are in our own lives and what point we're trying to convey and who we're talking to. The same story that you might tell 1,000 times will have subtle variations depending on the person or the place or how you're feeling. And I feel like in magical realism in games does sometimes capture the sort of vagaries of stories, but I can see that, like, for some people there, it just could fog things.
Yeah, and I want to make this clear as well. My problem is not with the concept of magical realism. My problem is with the common executions of it. I mean, one of my favorite games we've covered for the show is The Beginner's Guide. I mean, you've got other games like The Stanley Parable. These games are far from literal, and they really put forward this idea of the unreliable narrator, and I wouldn't necessarily say that they're magical realism in all cases. Some moments of The Beginner's Guide probably are, but that style of execution where I just feel like there's so much more thought in it, and it's just so much more precise when compared to things like this, which is more about, I'm trying to figure out the best way to phrase this without sounding like I'm dissing on the game, but like when you use things like allegory and metaphor and magical realism, you can be coming from a perspective of, we are going to make a point and everything is going to come back to this point, and every metaphor we use and every visual metaphor we use and every element, every technique of storytelling that we place in this experience is going to be about supporting that point and supporting that theme. Then there are other kind of games or other experiences that come from a more sort of sensory place. It's like, okay, we're going to use magical realism because we can have fun with it, and we can make you feel
terror,
things and
enjoyment,
we can bring you on this journey that has, you know, these weird kind of spectacles that make you feel kind of out of place but also kind of understood at the same time, and that's still good, right? Like, all of that is still great, but I do feel like this game is kind of somewhere in the middle, where especially when we come back to that Molly thing, where I just feel like that whole thing about I'm hungry and I'm going around and turning into a sea monster, it just doesn't really click with the rest of the game. And then we have other characters like Milton and Lewis. So Milton is, and this is the weirdest example of this, Milton, I think, is the king from The Unfinished Swan, right?
Yeah. If you read what I would find to be the most emotionless and terrifyingly cold Wikipedia article in the world for What Remains of Edith Finch, it does mention in there that, yeah, Milton is the king from Unfinished Swan.
Yeah, so Milton is the only character who you don't see the explicit death of, but he finds some paintbrush in some room and then goes into the magical realm, and it's kind of implied, like, his room is covered in imagery from The Unfinished Swan.
Yeah.
Like, it's a clear and unambiguous reference to that game. The only point of ambiguity I had was whether he was the king or whether he was supposed to be the kid, but the king makes a lot more sense. And so you've got this reference to Unfinished Swan, and it's almost like, hey, that's a weird thing we can throw in there. That's kind of like fun and self-referential, but it doesn't actually relate to any other themes in the game. And then you've got Lewis, and I think that Lewis is one of the more affecting stories in the game. Lewis is Edith's
brother.
Yeah. And Lewis, we should probably have warned this up front, but content note here, we're going to be talking about suicide.
Yep. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So Lewis is implied to have a substance. Not implied. Is
pretty explicit.
Yeah. It's established. It's established that Lewis has a substance abuse problem and sees a psychiatrist for issues of at least depression and to some extent delusional psychosis, where he often imagines himself basically as a character in a video game and lives his life more in his, quote, imaginary world than he does in the real world. And he gets a job at a abattoir.
His mother gets him a job, but yeah, it's a cannery, to be specific.
A cannery, but it's, you know, it's an abattoir for fish.
Yes.
And his job is to behead the fish and put them on the conveyor belt so that they can be further processed for canning. And the story takes place as him, where you're on the production line of him grabbing a fish, putting it in the guillotine to take the head off the fish. And as they're going through the story, there's this little window in the sort of the left part of the screen that shows what he's imagining at that point.
Yeah.
And as it continues, that grows and grows and grows. And it goes through a couple of video game genre references of your classic old school RPG and then something a little bit more like a Diablo-esque kind of thing. And
it gets more fantastical and there's more characters in there and it takes up more and more of the screen. And the whole time you are still cutting the heads off fish. So with the mouse, you're moving your hand around to the head
guide the fish, yeah.
And with your WASD, you're moving this character around this fantasy world, and as it grows and grows in his mind, it becomes more real for him.
Yeah.
It slowly takes
and
up.
Becomes, for want of a term, higher fidelity. So it starts off as like a very plain, top-down labyrinth thing from like the 80s, and then becomes a little bit more like a mid-90s Diablo-esque style RPG perspective.
And then it moves from that to even to be this fully interactive story where you kind of guide where he goes and who his love interest is, and you're sailing around, liberating kingdoms and exploring.
Yeah, and the narration of this point is provided by Lewis's psychologist in a letter to Lewis's mother about what probably motivated him to take his own life. And she's talking about more and more he retreated to his imagination and he understood that the real Lewis was actually the Lewis in his mind, not the Lewis in the real world, and that kind of thing. And for me, as a person who has experienced depression, this didn't really land with me either. Like I said, I feel like it was one of the more powerful stories, but it did not mirror my experience of depression at all. And I feel like this is an element that sort of kept me distant from a lot of the things in the game. Even though this is the last story you see, pretty much, of the characters in the game, it's a sort of a confirmation of the suspicion I had in, say, the Gregory story, where I'm like, if I had lost an infant child, would I appreciate this tone? Would this speak to me? I don't know, but I ask the question, would it? And I suspect that, at least for me, what I imagine my experience of that would be like, this would not speak to that. I feel like it is a jovial kind of approach to that topic, which I wouldn't appreciate. And I feel a similar way about this Lewis story. This story ends with Lewis in the video game kneeling down to have the crown placed on his head and become the king of this fantasy realm that he's invented for himself. The metaphor being there that when he's kneeling down, you can see the fish beheading guillotine that he's been using in the, quote, real life sections of his job. And the implication is that he beheads himself in the industrial equipment of his workplace. So it's dark.
Yes.
And I feel like they finish on that dark note, which they don't really finish on in Gregory's story. And they don't really finish it on a lot of the stories. There's one of the, I forget which child it is, but their story is quite short. They're trying to do a full loop on a swing. And I thought this was one of the most effective stories in the game, honestly.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're trying to do the full loop on the swing. They lose their grip and they end up falling over a cliff and dying from the fall. That story, tonally, is very childlike and curious and kooky and doesn't really end on a very dark note, even though
a kid flies off a cliff and dies.
Yeah, but from a tonal perspective of the structure of that story, do you agree or disagree?
I don't really know where I'm sitting with this at all. For me, when I experience these stories, I exist in this place where I hold the sadness and the joy that they're trying to portray in my hand at the same time. So in my mind, I sit with both of them. So when I'm imagining the kid going around the swing and hearing his brother's narration, I picture both the horrible tragedy and also the fact that at the end of that vignette, he flies through the sky because he was always wanting to be an astronaut. The game doesn't show you the kid crashing to the ground. It shows you flying through the sky, right? I can't, unfortunately, I lack the words and the understanding to put into context how these stories really resonate with me. Because you talked about the story with Lewis and he's, you know, the sort of feelings he had with depression. I was looking more at it as like a story about dissociative kind of disorder, because it doesn't speak to me as a story of depression at all, something that I also experienced in my life. But as a story of dissociation, it is something I found very personally reminiscent. And I feel like when I talk about this right now with you here, it's like I'm just sitting here going, this game spoke to me and it didn't speak to you.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm saying the same thing. Like, where you say it's difficult for you to find the words to talk about how it resonated with you, I struggle to find the words of how it failed to resonate with me.
Yeah.
Because, again, when I say these things from a certain perspective, they seem like they work on paper. But I do understand what you're saying. And the truth is, letting go and having a greater flexibility in your suspension of disbelief and your faith in the story to take you to a place that matters, if, like, for want of a better term, you know what I'm trying to say? Like, I think there is a level of trust there, right? Where if you trust that this game is going to treat you well and that you're going to leave it feeling happy that you spent the time and you gave the game your time and your attention and your emotional energy, I feel like you probably would have a better experience in it than if you're someone like me who's a little bit less willing to go ahead and do that in a game like this.
And also, I feel like everything the game is covering with the talk of families and the house and exploring death are things I've been thinking about a lot lately in terms of legacy and family and what that means to me and how I relate to it. I mean, right now I have older relatives, grandparents, who are reaching a point in their life that it might be the end of their time. And so this story about the death of all of these family members, which it felt like it was speaking exactly to my experience. And I did read some articles on the game, and I found it very interesting. There's two articles that I'll probably link to. One by Jess Joho. Half the article is about her own experience with her sister and her struggle with cancer and how the developer on this game's mother died during the creation of it. In fact, she's like credited at the end of it. And then the other article by Cara Ellison was sort of more talking about the mechanics and structure of the game. And it really feels like these are the two spaces people occupy.
Yeah, like there's a truth to the idea of that. I'm certainly thinking of this more mechanically, I think, than you are. Both, as I said, from a story analysis point and also from a gameplay point in some ways. But I do really, I know that you're not sort of accusing me of anything here, but I think it's important for the sake of the audience to reiterate that I did not go into this game resistant. I expected it to really take me on a moving journey.
Yeah.
The other thing too is that I am willing to give my emotional time and that kind of thing to a game like this. And I have also experienced the loss of people very, very close to me. Not necessarily family members, but incredibly close friends at different ages. And like I said, this just doesn't resonate with my experience of death. And perhaps in some ways, it's because the death of people who are close to me were more random than that. Like a car crash, for example, is one. And this game doesn't really approach the whole, it just came out of nowhere kind of thing. It's more talking about like this chain of, like you say, like legacy and family and that kind of stuff.
Especially as the game memorializes all of these deaths, you kind of are approaching an inevitability that everybody has passed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is truth to that. That's worth considering. The idea that if people are coming to it from a purely emotional place, they might resonate with this game a little bit more than if they come from a more analytical or critical or mechanical place. But coming from the latter of those two approaches doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have the experiences that this game is trying to connect with. And I feel like I have enough of those experiences that I should be able to at least access this, but it isn't really speaking to my conception of how these things work.
And I think to me, it's kind of come to this point where I think of What Remains of Edith Finch as, to put it a bit reductively, like a painting, especially like an abstract kind of painting, you know, those blank canvases that people display. It's like a divisive kind of art where it is pretty mechanically sound, but it affects people differently. And I feel like that could just be down to our biology or the
Yeah, yeah. Biology, in terms of like the metaphorical kind of culmination of our experiences, less so than our actual genetic makeup, but yeah.
Oh, who even knows, man? Like, there could be synapses that are there because of reasons that we can't comprehend, that we look at one thing and like it. And I feel like there's that point where we're coming to it. I don't think that you're wrong for not liking
it. Yeah, and I don't think anybody is wrong for liking it. But there are a couple of things I do want to say that sound shitty, but I'm going to say them because I feel they were thoughts I had while playing this game.
Sure.
The first is something that is sometimes referred to as the David Cage bump, which is where we get a game that very badly wants to be a movie and is about emotional things rather than arcadey scores, and sometimes the reception for that game is boosted because it's trying to be artistic and that kind of thing.
And that's sometimes rare as well, so it's like people cluster around what pillars are there.
Yeah, and that is a very reductive way to dismiss a game. I would not say that this game is only people pretending it's good because they think it's artsy and want to seem smart. But there is, to some extent, a truth to the fact that certain games are given more benefit of the doubt because of the way that they're put forward. I feel like this game is a perfect candidate for that kind of slight advantage in conversation surrounding it. To me, I kind of look at this and go, and again, I hate to do this, I hate to turn games into a competition, but we have played Journey relatively recently on this podcast, and also before starting the podcast, we've both played Firewatch, and both of those games are better in almost every way I can think of than this one. Like, I don't want to dismiss this because it's not as good.
And but I hate to just be here and say, like, I agree with you, but this one still spoke to me more.
Absolutely. Right? But I just want to make it clear that even when a game or a piece of art is trying to say something, how well it says that does matter. After I finished Firewatch, I thought a lot about myself. After I finished Life is Strange, I thought a lot about myself. And in terms of which one of the two games, What Remains of Edith Finch or Life is Strange, has themes that are a little bit more shallow, I'd probably say Life is Strange doesn't go quite as deep into very serious themes as
being
as
a teenager and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Like, obviously, it has those elements of being a teenager, and I don't want to dismiss those as being shallow or whatever, but the way it constructs its plot is more gamey than this is, I guess, is really what I'm trying to say. And then, you know, we compare that with Journey, and Journey is nothing but metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, and I just...
What's the point you're trying to reach?
The point I'm trying to reach is this. Execution matters, and I know that's a kind of a shitty way to phrase it, but if you try and say something and say it poorly, your art doesn't reach as many people, and it doesn't speak to as many people, and that is important to consider.
I get what you mean. At least I think I do. Let's see if I actually do.
What I guess I'm trying to say is you were kind of alluding to this idea that in a lot of ways, the differences between whether or not we appreciate this game is subjective. I think there are also matters that are not quite as subjective as that. It isn't just that you're more open to going on an emotional journey than I am. I think that this game fails to invite people in as well as it could.
And I think it's sometimes difficult to talk about something because, especially when you're talking about what I consider to be like the finesse, that final 10%, that last push that makes something go from a average experience to something being worthwhile is like both very small but very important. You can design a bug-free game that runs really well, but if it doesn't have that little bit at the end that really just cements it and can bring everybody on, I think that can be applied to all media. That can be a problem. And sometimes it feels like that can be like splitting hairs, but when we talk about creating things, it does become important because at some point we can't just be like announcing, I'm going to make a game about this. And then that is the sum of how people feel.
I feel like the element X that we're kind of dancing around here is unity of purpose. That when we think about Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons or Journey, one of the things that really impressed both of us about those games is that they were so clear in what they were trying to achieve.
Yeah, there was singular in purpose.
Yeah, and everything worked well on each level of design to support that. And I feel like this game, being a walking sim, is primarily about writing. And when the writing, which is like 90% of what you're experiencing in this game, writing in the grander sense, not literally just the words that are spoken, even on just that one design level, of the structure of the plot and the structure of these individual stories doesn't quite come together as much as I think it needed to for me to really be pulled in by it. And like I said, I guess what I'm really dancing around here is, yes, it's a very subjective game and different people will have different opinions on it. But I feel like the difference between me being pulled in by it and not is not so much me being like, oh, I don't want to be taken on an emotional journey. I'm not going to get tricked by you, emotionally manipulative game. It's that the game failed to build a coherent enough structure to bring me into it. From even just the narrative perspective, it lacked that. One of the things that I think really stuck out about that to me as well is, and this is kind of nitpicky, but one of the themes in the game that we talked about was, you know, the game discusses the power of stories. And at least half of the game, probably a little bit more, is talking about this kind of fatalism where all of these characters are inheriting this Finch curse from the people prior to them. And there's this idea that there is actually no curse. It's just a self-fulfilling prophecy because they're so obsessed with death. And they talk about the danger of stories and, you know, different characters try to silence stories. And even Edith Finch herself, in the journal that she is writing, says it would probably be better if I didn't write any of this and it all just died with me. And so you have this game that's kind of suggesting that you're wasting your time by playing it. And I know that sounds really, you know, hot takey, but I find that frustrating to some extent, that one of the themes of a story that is so self-indulgently about stories is that stories don't matter and are probably best left untold. That it's just such a bizarre failing. When I say failing, that's perhaps a bit harsh. It's such a bizarre contradiction. And
see, yeah, sorry. I just interrupted David. I can't believe it.
Hell has finally frozen over.
So this has come up in a few games. I think people accuse the Beginner's Guide of being like a game telling you you can't critique things, which I feel like is missing the point.
Yeah, absolutely 100% missing the point of the Beginner's
Guide. And I would probably agree with you that the way the game is trying to talk about stories and their power, it isn't perfect. But when I think about telling stories, it does remind me of playing games as well. And sometimes I love it when a game tells you how long you've been playing it and are you sure you don't want to go outside? I think that in sort of having people talk about the power of stories in a game that is just stories, it is constructive because it gives people that might not have thought about it that idea.
Yeah, and the theme itself is not inherently the problem. I'm reminded a little bit of a common critique of Beauty and the Beast, which is that in Beauty and the Beast, the whole quest of the movie is for this guy to recognize his toxic behavior and turn back into a person. But the whole joy and fun of the movie is in him being a beast and having this magical castle full of singing, dancing candelabras.
I do remember the dancing candelabras.
Yeah, and so there's a contradiction there between what the audience actually enjoys about the picture and what the final reward of that picture is. There's a contradiction there. And so when I'm talking about this, the idea that stories can do damage or that stories need to be approached critically or that there's a self-fulfilling nature to fear and myth or something, those themes are awesome themes. I don't think they land in this, which is a collection of weird magical realism stories that they're supposed to be, at the very least, a momentary satisfaction from. You're supposed to enjoy the moment of these stories, right? You're supposed to be affected in some way by these stories as they're happening and have this also be kind of making the point that the tragedy that befalls this family is giving into those stories. Well, like, it doesn't really work.
See, but I think it provides characters on both sides of that. Like, Edith Finch's mother, Dawn, seals all of the rooms where all of these stories are kept, right? And Edith Finch's grandmother, puts peepholes in so that people can still look into them. The game is trying to talk about both of these things. It's not just saying that stories are the devil. Oh God, why do we ever repeat them?
Of course it's not. Like, I totally understand that it provides both perspectives. I feel like the structure and the cohesiveness and the delivery, the competency of the delivery of that theme is just lacking and it becomes kind of messy and not in a way like, again, not in a way like Soma or The Beginner's Guide leave you with questions that it expects you to ask of yourself and answer. I feel like there just wasn't really any exploration or an encouragement for exploration there. It feels like the contradictions just kind of prevent further questioning and further self-questioning. You know what I'm trying to say? It just feels like kind of a ball that doesn't really flower into anything.
It's like there's all these stories that explore a very loose theme, but you're not feeling like they actually produce questions within you that you take away from.
And again, we come back to that term anthology. Like, if you read an anthology of short stories, they're kind of loosely connected and they might have these thematic or iconographic links, but they don't necessarily produce a single message, or they don't really produce a single question or build around a single question. And so if you think about something like The Twilight Zone, which is an anthology TV series, the general kind of thing is spooky horror, or Black Mirror is the general kinds of dangers of technology in modern society. But if you tried to bundle all of those up and analyze each of those stories in the way that you would analyze a movie that has a singular narrative and a singular purpose, it's not going to work. And I feel like this is so much more of the anthology style of it than the single coherent text. And that's not to say that that's a bad thing. It's just, to me, it doesn't allow the fullness of that emotionally affecting experience and all of that kind of thing that we're talking about.
So it's kind of like it's not utilizing the strengths available to it, and that is causing, like, frustration.
In a way, I guess really what I'm trying to say is, like, for me to be able to say I was really taken on a journey with What Remains of Edith Finch, What Remains of Edith Finch, the anthology thing, needs to be more together. And I feel like, again, I don't want to be reductive. I feel like if I had have gone into it with more of an expectation that these stories were a bit more unrelated than they are, or, you know, it didn't really, again,
it didn't sell the anthology to you.
Yeah. And my brain is forming this shape. And I'm struggling to describe what it is. Like, I keep using words like ball and tangle. But there's something about these things pressed together into the game of What Remains of Edith Finch that doesn't have a purity of form. It doesn't have the elegance that I'd need it to have.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, when you're doing woodworking and, like, those joints, or like, let's do a more appropriate one. When you get a piece of RAM and you slide it into a motherboard and it just clicks right into place and it forms what's almost like a perfect connection. It's like those parts don't fit together, so everything has lines.
Yeah, and the cable management on What Remains of Edith Finch just leaves something to be desired.
Don't knock my metaphor.
No, I'm obviously playing with it, but, like, it is, you're not wrong. Like, there's something about, like, have you ever seen a PC where someone just bought the cheapest parts they can and just jammed it all into one case?
Yeah.
And then you see these other things.
That was
that you
my
see
first
on, like,
PC. Yes.
Yeah, and, like, my PC. But then you see these things on, like, Linus Tech Tips or whatever, and they're made with such clear ideas of the final presentation and the final product. And you were kind of joking with that analogy, but maybe that's sort of what I'm getting at. It's the final product isn't stitched together quite as finally. I can see the seams.
And that's why I'm sort of just sitting here going, who cares, David? It can emotionally affect you. And why my answer is, like, we're just sitting around this kind of thing, and it's just, I think that's just the way it is.
That's honestly the truth. Like, I really like The Last Jedi. That has structural flaws, but I really like that movie because it took me where it needed to go, and so I forgive those flaws. And I am less forgiving of what I perceive to be structural flaws in What Remains of Edith Finch.
Although we probably agree that it isn't garbage, though.
Oh, yeah, God, not by a long shot. Yeah. I want to make this really clear. Like, it sounds as though we're disagreeing because we're talking about points of distinction. This is still a good game.
Yeah.
But for me, it is, and I hate to say numbers, but it is like a 7.5. If I did a game of the year list for 2017, this game probably wouldn't be on it.
Yeah.
It is good, but for me, not really much more than what the word good means.
Yeah, sure. God, how do you recommend something when it's like, you might have a great experience, or it might be fine?
I think these are the kind of games, though, that people kind of know whether or not they're going to like them before they're into them. And like I said, it is eerie. It is almost unsettling how identical my expectations of the unfinished Swan were to What Remains of Edith Finch, and the actual play experience was in relation to those expectations in both cases. Like, I was expecting something really quite good and got something pretty good.
I can't wait for Giant Sparrow's next game because I know I'm going to love it, right? Anyway, that's us, I think, rambling a lot about What Remains of Edith Finch. It's pretty clear what we think about it, but David, do you want to take us through the promos for the outro?
I would love to. If you like what we do, if you like what we do, You can find us on iTunes. You can subscribe there and give us a review. We appreciate that quite deeply. Our website is slowpokespodcast.com, where you can find links to basically everything we do. Our Twitter account is @slowpokescast, and our Facebook account or page or whatever it's called is facebook.com/slowpokespodcast. Yep. John, why don't you tell the audience about our next game?
Oh, I wish I could. All I know is its title, which is Volume. And I honestly know pretty much nothing else about it.
The only things I know about Volume is that I think it's like a stealthy, sneaky thing, but it's made by one of my favorite indie developers.
That's true.
Mike Bithell, who also made Thomas Was Alone and Subsurface Circular.
Yes.
He is a very talented game maker, and I'm very much looking forward to finally getting around to Volume, which came out a fair while ago.
Yes,
like
yes.
A fair while ago.
Yeah, we have been playing a lot of new games recently. We need to go back in time. get back on that Slowpokes train.
Yeah, really live up to our name. But I'm really looking forward to this. Also, fun fact, you probably don't know this, Jim Sterling voices a character in it.
Oh, I did know that.
Ah.
I don't know which character, though, so when I hear his voice,
I know
voice,
which character.
I can't wait to experience it. I'll be just like playing along, and I'm just like, oh my god, that's a large man with a bowler hat. Well, this has been fun. We hope you all enjoy yourselves.
Join us next time for Volume. I've been David.
I've been John.
Thanks for joining us for the Slowpokes.